Fancy a game?
I am so gee darn pissed right now.
Can I ask the possibly stupid question?
Your stupid question is asking me if you can ask it.
I was okay when you kept me in an arm's length because everybody said that's just
technically correct.
Where were you planning on shooting him from? The f***ing moon? If you'd have backed up any further, you'd have had to mail him the bullets.
That's how he operates.
With Tyler Bischoff.
This is why no one likes you.
Hello, Noah's Ark. Tony Sanchez will join us at 10:30, day after signing day for UNLV football. We've got some Golden Knights to get to. They play tonight in Detroit. Brandon Peary is going to be a healthy scratch, apparently. But we'll yell about Brandon Peary. We didn't get to it yesterday. He's a con man. But UNLV won, finally. Finally. And first off, by the way, the Mountain West tricked us all. We thought that was a close game. How the hell did that end up as an 11-point win for UNLV? That was a one-point game with 3 minutes to go. UNLV still wins by 11. They tricked us. Mountain West was like, uh-oh, you got a close game for you. Nope, not allowed to happen. So UNLV in Mountain West play. The first game was Colorado State. They won by 2 points, that goaltending there in the final seconds. Since then, every single UNLV game has been decided by double digits. This is stupid. This continues to be stupid. It makes no sense. But I want to talk about the last 3 minutes of this game because that's where UNLV won. They beat BYU. They beat Boise State 83-72. And again, Boise State cut the lead down to one with about 3.5 minutes to go. And then UNLV won from there on out. And honestly, the analysis of those last 3 minutes is you can break it down as simply as this. UNLV made shots, Boise State missed shots. Like, the quality of shot for each team was about the same. But UNLV scored on 6 of their last 7 possessions. Boise State scored on 1 of its last 7 possessions. I would say on those 7 possessions, if we look at UNLV defensively, I would say they played good defense on 2 of those 7 possessions. They got a turnover where nobody got beat off the dribble. They didn't get lost on any screens, and they got a 5-second call with some good pressure defense. So they got a turnover that was good defense. And then the very last possession of the game, Clyburn blocked a guy's shot from like 8 feet behind the 3-point line. Those were 2 good defensive possessions. The rest of their defensive possessions in the final 3 minutes, they gave up a backdoor cut for a layup. That was the only time Boise State scored. They gave up 3 3-pointers that you would consider open. Like one of them, Noah Robotham bit on a pump fake and went flying into the sideline. And the guy just missed the open three. Their best 3-point shooter got an open three in transition. He just missed it. And then there was another Boise State turnover in there where UNLV blew a rotation, left a guy wide open under the basket, but the pass to the guy was like 5 feet too high, and it resulted in a turnover. So Boise State didn't score down the stretch, but it wasn't really because UNLV played some lockdown defense. It was more about Boise State missing shots. Meanwhile, UNLV made 6 of 7 free throws. Robotham drills that deep three. They get the backdoor cut to Clyburn. So it comes down to, like, give UNLV credit. Like, they made the shots late. Boise State didn't. Like, the plays were there for Boise State to make, and they didn't make them. The plays were there for UNLV to make, and they did. And that's why UNLV won this game. Like, that's really as simple as it is. Like, neither team played particularly good defense in the final 3 minutes of this game. One team made shots, and the other team didn't. That's why they won. So that's really what happened over those last 3 minutes. What I'm trying to figure out, though, is like how much this win means sort of towards projecting the future. Like, did they prove they can, you know, compete with the best teams in the Mountain West? I'm still a little hesitant, largely because I think the 3-point shooting from UNLV masked a whole lot of problems. They did beat Boise State. Here's the thing. Boise State's 5-5 in the Mountain West. UNLV, that's the first team they've beaten in conference play that has a record that's not a losing record in the Mountain West. All the other teams they've beaten have a losing Mountain West record. So they technically haven't beaten a team with a winning record in the Mountain West yet because
5-5.
Boise State had a winning record going into the game, but because they lost UNLV, they don't anymore. It is refreshing to see them just in a game. Like yesterday, I set the bar so low and was like, hey, just be competitive. Like, have a lead in the second half, and they did that. And they closed out the game, and they're actually good in the final few minutes. But
the problems and the 3-point shooting masking it. They were 14-26 from three. It's 54%. That's ridiculous. That's just stupid. Some of those were the results of getting open looks off of good offense. Like, you had Hardy driving in, kicking it out, and they move it while the defense is rotating. Like, they had good possessions, but then, like, take Robotham's late three. He's just 6-7 feet behind the three-point line. The defense is playing off of him a little bit, and he's like, all right, I'm breaking off the play and shooting the three. It's not really, it's not a bad shot because he's not really covered, but it's not like a good shot. Like, it's not like, it's not like, oh, hell yes, we want that every time down the floor. So, like, some of it was that. It was just, yeah, we're just
cross half court, pull up.
Yeah, we're just taking the three now because we're somewhat open. So they've shown us they can drill a bunch of threes, and that gives them a chance to win pretty much every game they play. Like, if they can go 14-26, like, they can win any game they play, especially against anybody not named Nevada, because anybody not named Nevada can play terribly. And that's what Boise State did over the last 3 minutes. So they've shown they can do that. Now, the problems, mainly defensively, they could not guard Boise State. It was a bad display of defending screens. They were lost again, like the Utah State game, in terms of, hey, do we want to switch this or not switch this? Do we need to rotate now? They were late to rotations. Like, there were a lot of times where it looked like I shouldn't say they didn't know what defensive scheme they were in, but they were very late in recognizing what defensive scheme they were in. Like, things would happen, and you could physically see them thinking, oh, how am I supposed to defend this? Oh, right. And then Boise State gets an open look. And again, even late in the game, UNLV didn't really do anything special to finish that game off. So offensively, though, they did get better in the second half. They had some problems offensively. The breakdown for you on their shots here, they took 26 threes. They only had 11 layups and dunks, 15 mid-range jumpers. It's a high number. They had a lot. They second half, they had a lot of good dribble penetration, and Boise State sort of tried to cut it off. That's why they got a lot of second half threes. But first half of this game and in parts of the second half, they got cut off a lot to the point where they couldn't get in the lane, and they just settled. They just decided, all right, I'm pulling up from 18 feet. Like, Noah Robotham at one point took a step back jumper with his heels on the 3-point line.
Yeah, I saw that.
It's a horrific shot. Like, that's the least efficient shot you could ever take in the sport. And, like, they settled for that a lot in this game, and the 3-point shooting master, because that's not a good breakdown. The 15 mid-range jumpers to 11 layups and dunks, that's just not good. But when you make 14-26 threes, that doesn't tend to matter because you still have a good offensive game. Oh, I thought you were going to say something.
No, I was just going to... I asked you before the show, if they continue to shoot above 50% from three, they'll continue to win games.
Probably.
So we have a blueprint.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter how bad our defense
is. You're right.
If as long as they shoot above 50% from three.
They should stop practicing defense and only shoot threes in practice.
Well, I think they make them all in practice as part of the problem.
Is that the problem?
Well, it's sort of like, yeah, I don't know. I just, it's always the whole, why don't they make their free throws? It's like, they practice their free throws.
No, just shoot threes. Who cares about free throws? You don't need those.
Yeah, but practicing threes, I assume it's the same thing. Where
those
it's
are only
like,
worth 1 point.
When you're in practice, you can drill a three.
Yeah.
It's just, you know, when you're in a game. Different situation.
Like at practice, they have the managers they got these big pad things for post drills, so they can, you know, you have like a 5'10" manager that's got a guard 6'10" in Baki Zhang, so they give him these pads so he can just beat the hell out of him Baki Zhang. It's funny. It looks like a lot of fun. They should just take the pads and throw them at people as they shoot threes. Like, that should be their practice. That should simulate game situations. We're just going to chuck these things at you, try to make a three. And don't get drilled in the face by one of these things. You got to avoid that at the same time. No, that's what you should do. I mean, you're right. They're not good. Like, they're not good at defense. They're just not. Like, their only hope on defense is either A, they play a team like New Mexico who has one good player, or B, the other team just stops making shots like Boise State did in the final 3 minutes.
Okay, so we
stop
have
practicing it.
We have a plan, and it is exclusively let them have the rim. Let the other team have the rim. Their shot will be worth two. Your shot will be worth three.
I mean, that is what happened in the second half of this game. Like, before that final 3 minutes, UNLV had taken the lead, and they had held on to the lead for the most part in that second half. Boise State was still scoring. The thing was, Boise State was getting layups, and then UNLV would come down and be like, all right, we got a three. like, oh, great, our lead went up. Because you're like, that's what happened in the second half of this game. Is UNLV was like, yep, we're just going to make threes. We can't defend you. We're just going to make a bunch of threes and outscore you. And it works. So, yeah, just practice threes from now on. Noah Robotham. He's a closer, right?
I mean, I guess he is now.
When the game's close. Like, well, he had the shot against BYU.
Oh, yeah, you're right. Where
he had the first game against New Mexico where he made a play offensively and defensively late in that game. He stripped Anthony Mathis late in that game to basically seal that one up. And now you have this game. I mean, those are the last two wins. Well, no, wait, that was the first New Mexico game. Ignore that. But in any, well, this wasn't a close game technically. In any of their kind of almost close games, Noah Robotham's the one that's making plays at the end of the game. Like, if they're in a game late, if that happens, if it's not a 20-point game with 4 minutes to play, Noah Robotham's the guy that makes the plays.
In which case, why is Noah Robotham out there if you're down by 20?
But you had the three that we talked about. You had the Clyburn backdoor, which, by the way, I don't know how that works still.
The backdoor layup?
Chris Clyburn's been doing it for 3 years.
It's the same play.
He stands in the corner. UNLV runs a ball screen, and for some reason, Chris Clyburn's man just becomes fascinated with the ball screen and stops paying attention to Clyburn. And Clyburn just runs down the baseline, they throw the backdoor pass, and he lays it in. They've been doing it for 3 years.
Maybe Clyburn's just like real nonchalant. Like, he's just like, nah, they're not. I'm not even in this play.
Yeah.
And so maybe.
Keeps happening. I don't understand how teams don't stop it, but every game. It's going to happen. Every time he's going to get this backdoor cut. And it works better now because they have better spacing, so there's not 45 big men in the lane trying to block Chris Clyburn's shot. But Robotham, he ended up having 21 and 10, regardless of the counting stats. Like, the 21 points is good. He was 5 of 6 from 3, and that's coming off the previous two games where he was 2 of 15 overall from the floor. So, like, he needs to be efficient. Like, I don't know that they need Noah Robotham to score 21 points in games to win, but they need him to make most of his shots. And that's what he did tonight, and that's why they were good. He also got 4 free throw attempts, and he had 0 in the previous two games combined. So they need him to be efficient. And he was beyond efficient last. I mean, 21 points on 8 shots is stupid. Like, that's just stupid. Like, that's as efficient as it gets. So they need him to be efficient and consistently efficient, too. That's sort of the big thing with Noah Robotham. Tony Sanchez is going to join us at 10:30, technically correct. Make sure you have the Be Connected Sports app downloaded. When you sign up for a new phone account, you can get $50 to wager. It's the Be Connected Sports app from Boyd Gaming.
Check out the podcast on lvsportsnetwork.com.
There are so many ways to be satisfied at the Orleans Hotel and Casino. Enjoy cocktails and steaks the way nature intended at Alder and Birch. Visit the newly updated Prime Rib Loft. Experience the all-new Bailiwick Gastro Pub to share unique dining selections, try new craft draft beers, and enjoy great live music. Dine at Andori Asian Kitchen for authentic Chinese entrees, or choose from a large selection of sushi and Japanese cuisine. Check out the all-new Copper Whisk Cafe, open 24 hours with a menu that is sure to entice any palate. So savor the latest and greatest variety of flavors at the Orleans.
Bischoff's Briefs.
Underpants.
No, I don't want to go to a party in your pants.
Bischoff's Briefs.
Underpants!
Bischoff's Briefs.
Very well.
Joel Tomboy played 7 minutes last night.
I love questioning playing time after UNLV wins. I need to officially add that to my brand. Team wins, question playing time. So Joel Tomboy got 2 fouls early in the first half, and he came out, and Nick Blair played power forward for pretty much the rest of the half. Then about 90 seconds into the second half, he got his 3rd foul. Comes out, Nick Blair goes in and plays power forward. UNLV went on a run, and Menzies never put Tomboy back in the game. Now, the reason I will complain about this, Menzies likes to stick with lineups that go on runs, and that's understandable. Like, that's nothing to be disappointed about. My issue with that theory, though, is the idea of causation. Nick Blair was not causing them to go on these runs.
I mean, at one point, Nick Blair was like 3 of 4 from 3. Though.
Yeah, that was all in the first half. Yeah. Talking about the second half.
Okay.
He was one. He had more personal fouls than he did made shots in the second half. Like, Nick Blair was just out there. He just happened to be on the floor when everybody else was playing better. And, like, I don't mean to dump on Nick Blair, but they're a better team with Joel Tomboy out there. And Nick Blair wasn't some sort of integral part of the offense scoring, and he wasn't an integral. I mean, they were all integral parts of the defense not being any good, but like they're better with Joel Tomboy out there. So again, they won. So questioning the rotation is foolish, but they're better with Joel Tomboy on the floor. And like, I get it. They were going on a run, and Marvin Menzies doesn't like to change things when they go on a run, but it's like, there's got to be some understanding of what's causing them to go on the run. Oh, it's Noah Robotham and Amori Hardy being really good. It doesn't really matter if Nick Blair's in there. And I guess you could make the argument that if you put Tomboy in there, he's going to take a bunch of shots and screw everything up. Maybe I could buy that. Maybe Nick Blair was playing just the best defense of anybody else. It was just slightly less crappy than everybody else. But like, I just, to me,
you're winning the margins, Tyler.
Exactly.
You're winning the margins.
They're better with Tomboy. And I would have liked to have at least seen Tomboy play in the second half. And just because they went on a run, they didn't. But at least Bryce Hamilton played 18 minutes.
The Raiders do not have a place to play in 2019.
How is this possible? Like, I know we've talked about the details of it, but just how? Like, it's not like this is something that sneaks up on you. Like, we all knew when the Raiders were flirting with Las Vegas, not even when they were approved, when they were just flirting with Vegas, we all knew, hey, they don't have a lease after 2018 in Oakland. And it's not like this is some small deal either that you can just ignore. They don't have a place to play in 2019. Like, I'm just amazed that it's February and the Raiders don't know where they're going to be playing football in August.
My favorite point, I don't remember which one of you brought it up last night, but it was literally, do I need to be getting an apartment somewhere?
Right.
Like, the team?
Like, they're not signing free agents right now, but like, what do you tell a free agent? Like, if you're trying to sign a free agent.
Like, Jordy Nelson literally probably has an apartment in Oakland that he's like, do I sublet this?
That's a good point. The guy's on the team currently. Like,
where are we playing?
Yeah. And I mean, it looks like it's going to be the Bay Area, but it might not be. So, yeah, I don't know. I mean, I guess they'll still practice in Alameda, regardless of where they end up playing. So I guess that's still where your home is. But I don't know. It's just very strange. Like, maybe this whole time Mark Davis has said, like, the Coliseum is the fallback plan, and he just wanted to see if there were better options. But I feel like that's giving him benefit of the doubt. Do we need to overproduce a segment of, like, if the Raiders have a home yet and, like, spin a wheel and it lands on a random city every day?
Yes.
Okay. I mean, as soon as we get it done, they'll agree to at least somewhere.
It'll be like Fresno.
Yeah. But, yeah, all right. We need to overproduce a segment on where the Raiders will play.
Malcolm Subban returned to practice yesterday.
So did Will Carrier. Both are on injured reserve. Both would require a move if they come back. Subban is easy. You just send down Max Legacy. He doesn't have to clear waivers. David Shane did report today that Legacy is still with the team this morning. So Subban, it doesn't look like he's coming off IR today, but being back in practice means he's probably coming back soon. But Will Carrier is the interesting one. There are two skaters that do not have to go through waivers to go back to the minor leagues, Alex Tuck and Jake Bischoff. They're not sending Alex Tuck down. They probably wouldn't send Jake Bischoff down for Will Carrier because that would leave the Golden Knights with just six defensemen, and they wouldn't have like a backup plan defenseman. So I'm assuming Jake Bischoff is on the roster until Nick Holden comes off of IR. But that means they'd have to make a move to bring Will Carrier back. Now, Ryan Carpenter got hurt, and he could potentially go on injured reserve, and you could just make that switch, put one guy on IR and call one guy off of IR. But at some point, unless they just continue to have guys hurt, they're going to have to waive somebody. And I'm curious as to who it'll be. Lindbergh, Carpenter, I don't know. We'll see it at some point in the future. But Gallant did say Carpenter was, quote, doing better, which doesn't mean much after your head bounced off the ice and you couldn't skate off under your own power.
Jerry Tarkanian lost two conference games by 17 points or more.
Thanks to Paul Gutierrez of ESPN. He was following up on the stat that I had earlier this week on 17-point losses. He went through all the coaches back to Tark. So Jerry Tarkanian, two losses by 17 or more in 206 conference games. Rolly Massimino had zero such losses in 36 conference games. Bill Baino had five in 76, and then Charlie Spoonhour had one in 36. And then Lon Kruger had three in 110, Dave Rice three, Todd Simon one, and then Marvin Menzies is at 11 now. That's all. Just somebody followed up with the older coaches. So still the same point I was trying to make earlier.
The Las Vegas Aviators will not host Big League Weekend this year.
I believe Major League Jerks. Baseball said they don't want anything to do with the new logo.
I stepped on your joke. That was a much better joke.
But the stadium won't be done. That's all this is.
Oh, yeah.
Like, Big League Weekend is what? Is in March, usually?
Yep.
End of February? Or March?
Beginning of March.
Okay.
I should know this. I have, like, 6 t-shirts from it.
Unbelievable. But, yeah, the stadium won't be done. And, like, they don't want to see Cashman Field ever again. So, they're not going to have it. It should be back next year. It's kind of similar with the Raiders. It's February 7th. The Aviator Stadium is supposed to open on April 9th. Are they going to have it done?
They said they would.
Yeah, I mean, I know the Don Logan, the president, told the RJ that, like, the swimming pool won't be done for opening day, which should be fine, I guess. I don't know. You can usually swim in April in this city, but he's like, the swimming pool won't be ready, but the stadium will be good to go. I don't know. It just seems like they're cutting it close. And actually, they do have a backup plan. Like, they're not fully confident either, because they have not canceled their lease at Cashman.
Yep.
Like, they are still the primary tenant of Cashman Field, because Las Vegas Lights, as soon as the Aviators cancel their lease at Cashman, the Lights can start doing soccer specific renovations, but they can't do anything because the 51s are still the primary tenant.
Yep.
So they've just got to sit there and wait for the 51s to back out. So the 51s, the Aviators, they're still saying, like, Cashman's a backup plan. Like, they sound
we're
confident.
We're holding the Lights hostage.
Yeah, but Cashman, they still technically have a backup plan at Cashman.
Chalice has been named the manager of Club Puebla.
This is the fourth time they've hired him.
He's got to have pictures of somebody's wife something.
He once got fired in season, and the players demanded they bring him back.
He doesn't make us run, like, or work out, or try hard, or show up.
Like, basically threatened to not play. So they rehired him and then fired him later on. Somehow Chalice failed upward, because he was the coach of one of the worst teams in the second division of American soccer, and he's now the manager of a team in the top division of Mexican soccer. I don't know how he pulled that off.
He's Chalice.
But the reason we're talking about it is Lights FC tweeted about it. So this is the headline of the story that they tweeted out. Fourth time's a charm. Puebla brings back El Chalice. Lights FC's tweet said, fourth time, ? It only took us once to learn.
So good. Yeah. Am I the only one that's out here thinking, like, when did the Lights Twitter account get kind of fun?
They've always been fun.
I mean, more or less the content's been fun. Like, here's our manager with a llama.
Yeah.
But now it's like, now they're punchy.
Now they're taking shots at Chalice. It's so good. And people are mad. So this is a selection of responses to this tweet. Show some class.
To the guy who got kicked out of the game and started chain smoking.
Yeah.
In the fan section.
Can't trust or follow clubs with this kind of approach to a former coach.
To the former coach that got kicked out and then went to the fan section and started chain smoking.
Unprofessional. When a manager leaves, usually you thank him for his hard work and dedication. Very low class.
They finished like second to dead last.
And this is my favorite. I was even planning on going to a Lights game this year, but since I just saw this tweet and found out Joel Wiecki, one of the best center backs in the world, is no longer part of the Lights, I lost all interest. Thanks, Lights. First off, Joel Wiecki is one of the worst center backs in the world. If you could pick one player to point to as why did Lights FC suck last year, it's him. He is so slow. If you wanted to see him play, he played last year. You had like 20 games you could have gone and seen him play. So yeah, why did people
see it? You could have seen him get burned in any of the 20 opportunities.
Why do people hate fun?
I don't know.
I don't either. Tony Sanchez will join us next. Have you ever wondered what it looks like inside Bischoff's briefs? Thanks to Manscaped.com, it looks phenomenal. Manscaped's precision engineered tools are optimized specifically For below-the-waist grooming and hygiene, I love their Lawnmower 2.0 trimmer with skin-safe ceramic blades, a nick-free manscaping experience every time. So keep the inside of your briefs like Bischoff's briefs. Go to manscaped.com and get 20% off and free shipping with discount code ESPN. That's code ESPN for 20% off and free shipping.
You're listening to Technically Correct with Tyler Bischoff, brought to you by Boyd Gaming.
If you pop 30, pop 30. Popping dirty.
Pop 30?
Yeah. Oh, he popped
like
dirty.
That. We gotta start using that more. Pop 30.
It means you tested positive.
Tyler Bischoff is...
No, it's fun. I like this phrase. Pop 30. I'm gonna start using this in everything. Lexington Thomas is gonna pop off a dirty run.
Technically correct.
Joining us now, head coach with UNLV football, Tony Sanchez. Signing day was yesterday, the second signing day for college football. But first, Tony, after UNLV basketball won last night, in some post-game video press conferences, we saw the players with Chick-fil-A in the background, and I'm curious, your players, what food do they get most excited for their post-game meal?
Well, the one that we get the majority of the time is also Chick-fil-A.
Okay.
I tell you, once in a while, if I need to motivate them in spring, we'll throw in some In-N-Out and they get fired up for that.
So if you guys just, like, paid for one of, like, the In-N-Out catering trucks to just sit outside the practice field, you'd have the best practice of the year.
Phenomenal. Are you kidding me? And usually what I do is I put one of the big boys back and say, if you catch a punt at the end of this practice tomorrow afterwards, we got In-N-Out and they get fired up.
Oh, okay. What's the conversion rate on one of the linemen catching a punt?
Well, based on the peer pressure from their teammates, it's pretty good.
So we look at your second signing day. Actually, first off, with signing days, it feels less fun. The second signing day used to be like the day for college football recruiting, but now it just feels fun because, I mean, you guys had most of your class done in the first signing day.
Absolutely. I mean, I don't know how else to put it. It's almost a little anticlimactic. You know, you do the majority of your work, and even the guys you sign in the second signing day, the majority of those guys, you kind of already have loaded in the barrel. There's just a couple of things that you're sorting through, you know. Some of those junior college guys, obviously they're not mid-year guys. You just want to make sure those grades come in. They're on par and they're doing everything they need to get their AA. You know, some of the high schools, it might be the same thing. You might be going in between deciding whether or not you're going to sign the guy or not. You do go and uncover a couple of stones. But, you know, with everybody pretty much taking a big chunk off the market, it does. It just makes it a little less dramatic.
It's been a couple of years now, and I think I want to ask you this every year just to see if anything changes, but does this early signing period, like, do you think it's benefiting the coaches of smaller schools more than it is sort of the bigger schools?
You know, originally I thought that. I thought it was a big, you know, advantage for us, and I still think it is. But I also think it's a big advantage for the really powerful schools, too, because they completely lock those classes up. They put a lot of pressure on the kids. They sign now or the thing's open. So what you're seeing is just seeing a lot of those big-time schools sign the overwhelming majority. And they might have 22 to 24, or maybe the whole class done, so they're just focused on 220. Yesterday you didn't see a lot of flips. I think I saw a receiver that went to Georgia, I believe, it was, or left Georgia or something like that. But there wasn't too many of those like there normally is. So most people are getting them locked in. The good thing for us is, you know, the overwhelming majority of our class, they're not fallbacks, because what used to happen is, you know, Christmas comes and goes, you come on back, you got a couple weeks before signing day, it's pretty clear this kid decides not to go to, you know, Pac-12 school A or B, and all of a sudden now they start scrambling. Where do they look? They look at Mountain West schools, and, you know, we've got some really good players, and we got four guys starting in the Pac-12 now that we had committed for over 7 months that we lost in the last couple of weeks, and that's just kind of the nature of the beast. Well, a lot of those guys, they're already signed, they're off the market.
So what jumps out to me with this class is the amount of JUCO transfers on the defensive side of the ball. I guess just how much in general are you counting on those guys to come in and be an immediate impact?
Well, you are. I mean, you know, when you look at that side of the ball, there's some things we needed to really get done. You know, in the linebacker core, we're pretty good there, but adding, you know, you can't pass up a guy like Vic Baramontes. He's a guy who can come in and make a big, big difference. You know, losing two seniors, you know, at defensive end, but then having Tedashi and come back, you kind of look at it for this year and the future, you know. So Devai Tuatasi, it was a great guy to bring in. And Noah McGregor, the biggest thing about him is he's a three-year player. So he was a qualifier coming out, had a great freshman year. Not a lot of people knew about him because he wasn't immediately available. So Noah's kind of interesting because he doesn't go into the junior class, falls into the sophomore class. And then, again, we wanted to, you know, beef up front, you know, losing a couple of guys. So the secondary is probably the biggest thing that everybody saw. You know, we needed to get some older guys there. You know, Perry having a surgery, Kenzie Daniels having a knee surgery. So we have two guys going into the junior year that are both not available for spring ball, and hopefully we get them back for camp. So we had a need to go get some older guys right there. And then at the safety spot, you know, I think moving Techman over and then bringing in one guy, Gammon Howard, really solidifies it back there. Good thing is we were able to redshirt so many guys. The safety we brought in last year, we redshirted a linebacker last year, two defensive ends last year. So the freshman class is a lot bigger than it looks. I mean, I think we redshirted, what am I looking at, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. We redshirted 10 kids last year. So when you look at the 10 we brought in, there's actually 20 in that class.
I certainly enjoy when you have, you know, Johnny Stanton blocking punts or Drew Techman is picking off passes. But I can't imagine as a coach you enjoy being in the position where you've got to put wide receivers at safety and you got quarterbacks playing linebacker. But does this class, do you guys finally feel like you're in a position of where you need to be depth-wise?
I think so. I mean, I think one of the biggest frustrations last year was, you know, like you look at the San Jose game and your entire secondary is out. And then the drop-off is big. You know, we got to avoid that. It's one thing to have guys out. It's another thing to have that drop-off be so drastic, and it really was last year. Had a lot of injuries, and even some of the backups, you know, were out at that point, guys like Alex Berry and such. So I think this really helps solidify that. It puts us really four deep everywhere, which we need to be. You know, Techman's an interesting kid, though, because he actually had a bunch of offers to be a defensive back coming on out, and he just wanted to be a wide receiver. So we knew at some point we already had that conversation that he could make the move. So I think he's in his natural position. And, you know, Johnny Stanton, you know, it's kind of funny. He always wanted to be a quarterback, and it kind of shows what his true natural position was too. So I think what that shows is that when you recruit, and I talk to coaches about this all the time, yeah, you recruit a guy for a spot, but if you can, you want to recruit the longest, fastest athletes you can, because they're going to find a way on the field somewhere.
So if we look at the offensive side of the ball, what's your favorite food?
My favorite food?
Yes.
Well, it's a tie between steak and pasta.
Okay, all right. We'll just take pasta. Would you sacrifice a year of pasta if it meant a year of Armani Rodgers being healthy for the whole year?
Oh, I'd become a vegan. Are you kidding me? Absolutely.
That's no doubter whatsoever.
You just look at the last couple years and you just put a win percentage and just even a competitive standard on when Armani's starting and when he's not, when he's hurt. You know, I mean, it's unbelievable. You look at that one stat and you're like, wow, that's kind of glaring. We played as good a football as anybody in the Mountain West for the first 4 weeks. You know, lost a tough, you know, rainstorm game on the road to Arkansas State by 7 points, and he was tremendous. He had a really good game against SC and tie game in the fourth quarter. And then, man, I mean, it shouldn't be one guy goes down and the wheels start to fall off, but it kind of happened. He went down. I think it was an emotional hit. Our defense hung in for a half against New Mexico in that last, like, 2 or 3 minutes. It just got ugly and took a while for us to find our legs, and all of a sudden you get injuries on the defensive side, and it's just a trickle effect. So when he's in there, I mean, again, you look at the end of the season, you know, even that San Diego game, he didn't play in, but that was the first game he was cleared to come back. There was kind of an energy there. Max played well, ran the ball well, defense kind of stepped up, got some guys back, and we played good football at the end, but Armani's a catalyst of it. He's, you know, and I think any team that's going to have a lot of success, you're going to have a pretty special guy back there.
Outside of obviously losing Lexington Thomas, who's one of the best running backs in UNLV history, you guys return almost everything else on offense, and you've had good offenses pretty much every year that you've been here. Is this the most sort of comfortable or confident you are in the offense?
By far. I mean, we just have so much. I mean, we return 10 offensive linemen that have started a game, and we're out there on the field running around today, you know, going into spring. We got 17 offensive linemen and 16 on scholarship. I mean, that's a big, big deal, you know, two guys coming in. So that whole thing's revamped and done. You know, we return guys like Woods and Presley and, Mekhi Stevenson and Tylee Collins. And, you know, there's up-and-comers like Pat Ballard. And, you know, we got a fifth-year senior coming in to kind of add to that, Jordan McCray. You know, Charles Williams, I think this is a big year for him. He's got to come in and kind of be that guy that we saw his freshman year, you know, be consistent. We got him for 2 more years. He's more than capable of doing it, so we have to see him do that. And then you bring in a guy like Courtney Reach, who kind of, it's funny, he kind of reminds you of Lexington coming in, as a freshman, same type of speed and, you know, small frame and all that. So we'll see if he can be as productive. But we feel really good about that spot. And then one of the biggest things at the end is you saw Gio Fallow and Noah Bean really start to insert themselves in the offense along with Jamal Neal. You know, he had a good running game against San Diego State. So those three guys there at that tight end / H-back, they're going to cause some problems for people. So, you know, we're optimistic about it, and as long as we keep our heads on straight, I think we can be pretty explosive.
45 points a game, right?
If we do that, we'd be all right.
So you guys added Biagio, Ali Walsh. Two questions on him. What sort of brought him back, and what's his current situation as far as possibly sitting out this next year?
Yeah, you know, he had a couple family things that, you know, they had to work through, so that's one of the reasons, well, the main reason is the reason he came back. And it was, you know, it was kind of a natural fit coming back to his hometown, and I think there's a level of comfort being here, and, you know, we've coached him before. But whether or not he'll be available this year, we don't know. Obviously, there's an appeal process going on with the NCAA right now. They've been pretty good about stuff like that. Guys coming home for family reasons. So, you know, if we get him back, that's just another guy we add into it. You know, if not, you have him for 2 years after that. So, I think, you know, either way, we got a really good player on our hands, and we'd love for him to be available this fall.
Do we have any set date for the practice facility opening?
It's in the spring. It's late spring. I mean, it's one of those deals where they're cranking away. You know, you've heard as early as April 1st, and, you know, I mean, I think that's pretty optimistic. I think most likely you're going to see towards the end of April, early May, but it'll be done this spring. I mean, it's, you know, and I tell you what, I encourage anybody from the media to get a chance, call Mark Lawrence and walk through that thing. It is absolutely unbelievable. I mean, you know, we've talked about it. You've seen pictures on it, but when you walk through and see the size and the scope and the scale of that thing, it really kind of shows you that, like, oh, this is not just some, you know, tiny little building that's going to, you know, it's going to make a major impact on academics, you know, on the physical training, on the medical side of things, you know, just the students' well-being. I mean, just there's going to be such a synergy and energy to the thing that it's really going to impact recruiting, and it already has this year.
Coach, during press conferences, whenever this sound gets made,
about a 9-10,
do you ever feel like pulling an Ed Orgeron and just yelling, "I'm having a press conference here"?
Okay, do that sound again.
About a 9-10.
That's a door closing while you're talking during a press conference.
Oh, you know what? You know, okay, so it's two things, right? So when I'm in a press conference, you hear that door closing all the time. That's our guys going in to study hall. And those are our position meeting rooms. And because of the facilities we have to use our position meeting rooms as computer labs and study halls because we don't have them. So when they're opening them up, it just shows that, you know, hey, we're doing better academically, so I don't mind.
That's
it right
a good
now,
answer.
But it's a nice facility, we don't have to worry about it.
So wait, okay.
Good answer.
The new facility, is there going to be a press conference room that does not have doors constantly being opened?
We thought of you guys. You were the first people we wanted to make sure we took care of. So when you walk in the front entryway, you hang right, and there's a big room, tiers, got a beautiful window that sees out in the field, and it's just for press conferences.
Have you seen the Ed Orgeron video where I think it was the first signing day he's giving a press conference in their indoor facility, and twice he goes and yells at people to stop practicing?
Oh, you're kidding me.
Oh, it's great.
Oh, okay,
it's
we got to send that to him.
I don't know who it is that's practicing, but there's people like, I don't know, they're punting or just throwing footballs, and like twice he stops the press conference to go yell at them to shut up because he's trying to do a press conference.
Oh, that's hilarious. And there you go. Well, it's a good thing he didn't water boy him.
And, you know, I mean, it's Ed Orgeron, so it just sounds terrifying regardless of what he's saying.
Exactly.
Well, he is Tony Sanchez. He is the head coach at UNLV football. Tony, we appreciate your time.
All right, guys. Take care.
Thank you, Tony. There you go. So, Jared, you will have probably no more press conferences in which you get the door closing while Tony Sanchez is talking.
Good.
That is Jared's favorite thing. Like, when I come in and I'm like, all right, we're going to play this audio, Jared's just sitting there listening. He doesn't care what anybody says in it. He's just listening to hear if anything distracting happens in the background.
Like a truck backing up or something like that.
Like, that'll happen occasionally. You know, football press conferences, it's the door opening and closing. Basketball, it's the just balls being dribbled in general, because usually it's just while they're warming up or something like that. Sometimes there's an airplane. Those are always good,
that's
too.
That's the best.
That is the... You know it's a UNLV press conference and there's an airplane flying over.
Get in touch with the show on Twitter at @Bischoff_Tyler.
A very big sports story is happening.
Tyler Bischoff is...
If a very big sports story was happening, we'd know it.
We do know it. We just don't understand it.
You don't understand it.
Technically correct.
Thanks to Tony Sanchez for joining us. We'll have that up on the podcast if you missed it, lvsportsnetwork.com. I'll have it tweeted out not too long after the show, after we're done here. Golden Knights, though, they play the Detroit Red Wings tonight. We did not play this audio. We mentioned it yesterday. I forgot to tell you beforehand to get this audio, Jared, but Valentin Zhukov's post-game presser from yesterday. Sorry about that. I mean, we cut it yesterday after the show because we forgot about it. But this was better than his goal. And we're late to the game, and we're just now playing it. But Valentin Zhukov scores a goal. He talks to the media after the game. And unfortunately, because we are a weak media market, there isn't actually that much traveling media. The first questions in this come from Gary Lawless, who is a team employee. So it's like a media press conference, but it's not real media asking the questions here. Oh, they're also not actual questions. But here are the first couple of questions to Valentin Zhukov.
First goal with the Golden Knights and a big win for the team.
Yes.
Fun game for you?
Yes.
Yes.
That is so great.
You're going to eat lunch later.
Yes.
Just, like, one of my biggest pet peeves is talk about, like, you scored that goal. Would you talk about it?
No.
No. Technically, I answered your question.
Oh, it is so good. Like, apparently Valentin Zhukov doesn't like to talk. Like, apparently he didn't want to talk to the media when he first got here. Like, he, like, was here and was practicing and just didn't want to talk after practice to the media. I know Jesse wrote a story about him. I think it took him a while to actually get to talk to him. But, yeah, but when he's under pressure and doesn't get asked a question, he's just going to say yes, play it again.
First goal with the Golden Knights and a big win for the team.
Yes.
Fun game for you?
Yes.
Oh, it's so good.
Like, the best part is we didn't cut any of the yes. Like, he took a second to gather himself, like, what is he asking me?
What's a good way to answer this?
Yes. Yes.
All right, Brandon Peary is a fraud. He's a fraud. He's apparently going to be a healthy scratch tonight, according to David Shane of the Review Journal.
So, Jake Bishop? No.
Oh, I wish. Brandon Peary had 8 goals and 5 assists through the first 11 games that he played this year. In the last 6, he has not scored a goal, and he does not have an assist. So, almost, as soon as he hit 10 games, and as soon as Brandon Peary became a player that had to clear waivers to go back to the AHL, he stopped scoring. He's a con man!
Wait, you're blaming him. I'd blame the fan base for being like, you can't send him down! You can't send him down!
Oh, I was doing that too, and I can't blame myself. He was unstoppable to the point, like, he forced George McPhee to keep him on the NHL roster because he couldn't stop scoring, but now he's a scrub. And they can't send him down or else somebody will probably claim him off waivers. He pulled this over on all of us. Maybe this is why they don't play Jake Bischoff. They're worried he's going to be too good.
But only for a very limited.
Well, no.
Is this Lynn Sanity?
Yes, it is. Yes, Brandon Peary is Jeremy Lynn. But see, with Jake Bischoff, they can send him down because he's waiver exempt no matter what. I think they're afraid of this with Jake Bischoff, that he's going to be so good and he's a free agent at the end of the year that they won't be able to afford him. So they got to wait until they lock him up long term.
Now suck it, Tyler!